I'm Marco Werman, and you're tuned to The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. In case you're wondering whether our president-elect's tweets have an impact beyond U.S. borders, consider this. Today, South Korea said that one of Donald Trump's recent tweets is a clear warning to North Korea. Here's the background of this story. On Sunday, North Korean leader Kim Jong-un gave a speech in which he said his country is close to test-launching an intercontinental ballistic missile. Translation, North Korea may soon have a nuclear weapon capable of reaching the United States. No one is sure if that's really the case, but yesterday, Trump responded via Twitter. He said, quote, "It won't happen." Trump spokeswoman Kellyanne Conway told ABC that the president-elect was putting North Korea on notice with that tweet. We'll have to wait and see how North Korea responds. Right now, though, we're going to step back from the scale of global politics to bring the story down to the scale of human lives and the way North Korea and nuclear weapons have shaped one family. Daniel Gross has their story.
10 years ago, David C. Kong walked from South Korea to North Korea. At the border, guards inspected his American passport. They didn't like it when he tried to snap some pictures, but they let him through. And on the other side was an industrial city called Kaesong.
It was emotional just to go through, just to be in the northern side and with real North Korean people and talking to them. It was awesome.
Kaesong was a collaboration between two longtime adversaries. Companies from South Korea employed 50,000 workers from North Korea. For Kong, the city was a glimmer of hope, a symbol of Korean unity. But the teamwork didn't last. Last year, after North Korea claimed to test a hydrogen bomb, the project was shut down.
Politics took over, and so we're back now to where we were 10 years ago.
David Kong directs the Korean Studies Center at the University of Southern California, and one of his interests is nuclear weapons, so the trip to North Korea taught him a lot, but it also had personal significance.
My father was originally born in Northern Korea. At the time, it was one, under Japanese occupation.
Growing up, Kong heard stories about Korea before the division. The peninsula had a 1,000-year history of unity, and the Kong family lived through it.
I am the 39th generation of this family, right? My son and daughter, the 40th generation of these Kongs. And that's an extraordinary sense of belonging, not to a political regime, like, you know, no, I'm not a Korean citizen, right? But to a family and to a land and to a place. It's an extraordinary sense of belonging.
The paradox of the two Koreas is that they're unusually divided and unusually connected. Kong has made it his job to try and understand that.
In large part, my career has been made because, you know, sort of a personal interest in all of this. You can't deny I study international relations and nuclear weapons in North Korea because of where my father's from and where our family's from.
I asked Kong how his father felt about North Korea, and I expected him to tell me more stories he'd heard as a kid. But instead, he told me to visit the city of Livermore, California, and find out for myself.
Name is Sang-wook Kang. Kang is the last name, K-A-N-G. Retired from the Lawrence Livermore National Lab.
These days, the elder Kang is 81. He lives in the north, and his son lives in the south. Of California, that is. I asked Kang Sr. how he came from Korea to Livermore Lab, which happens to be a national center for nuclear weapons research. It was a winding journey, and it started when Kong was 10.
More than 60 years ago, 7 years ago, if I let myself go, then the childhood memories, people, and the beautiful countryside evoke very fond memories.
Kong remembers ice skating in winter and swimming in summer. His ancestors had lived in the same part of Northern Korea for centuries.
They grew up there, they got old there.
But in 1945, all that changed. World War II ended, the occupying Japanese army left Korea, and in the north, communism took over. Under communism, landowners lost their rights. The elder Kong's grandfather had a deed to their land, which was suddenly meaningless.
Then he one day burned the deeds. He says, "In my lifetime, I'll never go back."
The whole family moved south, to Seoul.
the sad state of affairs, same people being divided into, was, to me, very unfortunate.
Kang wanted to study physics, but post-war South Korea could barely provide electricity and sanitation for its citizens, let alone conduct science experiments. So Kang finally decided to move to the U.S., all by himself. He always planned to go back, but he liked America. He agreed with the American stance against communism.
I was 20 and a half when I came to this country. Then I said, man, I hate communism.
Physics led Kang to UC Berkeley, where he met his American wife. From there, he moved to a lab in New York, and then back to California, the Livermore National Laboratory. And here, in the 1970s, his anti-communist stance mattered a lot. Remember, the United States was facing off against the Soviet Union. When Kang joined the laboratory, he was asked a question. If the U.S. wanted him to work on nuclear weaponry, would he work on it? Kang said yes.
We have to have strong club just to give them the message. We have to make them feel that we are stronger. To do that, the only way is nuclear.
Basically, Kang is talking about a central Cold War concept, deterrence. The idea that when two countries have the power to destroy each other, neither one will. Most of Kang's research had to do with energy projects like solar and geothermal. But I asked Kang if he ended up working on nuclear weapons, too. He wouldn't answer directly. Defense work was shrouded in secrecy.
So that means that if you did work on nuclear weapons, you wouldn't necessarily be able to talk about it.
I wouldn't, no. Mum is the word.
Kang's home in Livermore is thousands of miles from his homeland of Korea. But in a way, his work at a nuclear laboratory connected him to the Cold War. And the Cold War stretched all the way from California to Korea. That's how the younger Kang, David, first got interested in nuclear weapons.
Even when, as a kid growing up, they always said, like in the 70s, if there's a nuclear exchange, we're number two on the Soviet list of targets.
David Kang said his father sometimes told stories, for example, about war games they played at work. Once, a bunch of Livermore scientists tried to estimate the damage that a nuclear attack might cause.
So what you do is you've got a lot of data on how things burn and blow up, and you know how nuclear weapons work. And so they took one model city, and he said they happened to have a lot of information about Detroit. And so they modeled what would happen if they nuked Detroit.
When the Soviet Union dissolved 25 years ago, deterrence may have seemed a lot less relevant. But in 2006, North Korea tested its first nuclear weapon. And suddenly, the same principle of deterrence applied to Kang's homeland.
Everywhere else in the world, no matter how bad it is, the Cold War is over. Right? Like, everywhere else, that's gone, except one place, and that's North and South Korea. And in a way, the fact that North Korea has nuclear weapons is, sadly, one of the reasons that unification or solving the problem is so hard, right? They have nuclear weapons precisely because it serves an end. It serves a purpose for North Korea, which is it keeps us from attacking them.
In other words, that same Cold War logic that the elder Kang brought home from work makes it incredibly difficult for the two Koreas to reunify. I wanted to know if David Kang thinks he'll ever see a reunified Korea. He's confident it will happen one day. The Cold War taught us that, too. Eventually, a stalemate has to end. But he worries it might take a while.
If that day comes, what will you be doing? What will you be looking forward to do? Or what will you be worried about?
I would love to fly to Seoul with my father. Wow, this is emotional. Rent a car and drive and go see where he was born. Wow. Well, I haven't even thought of that. That's what I will do.
When I visited David's father, I asked him what his hometown might look like today. And to answer that question, he showed me a book on his shelf about the Korean War.
And they show maps of the progress of front lines. See? And they show the line right in our neighborhood.
So your hometown became the front lines of the war?
Yes. My guess is that the village is completely gone, destroyed in 1950, October. My home.
Before I left, I told Kong what his son David had said, that he dreams of seeing where the family comes from. He talked about wanting to go back there with you.
Yes.
Maybe one day, he said. Maybe one day.
While I'm alive.
What do you think?
Yes.
Do you think it's possible?
You mean the reunification?
For you to see it.
My hope was, let's say, scale of 0 to 10 was like 9, 30 years ago. It's now down to 1. Used to be high. And then especially the prospect of my being alive with my son. So I'm glad that to pass on that desire to my son, because he's a good son. Proud of him.
For The World, Daniel Gross, Livermore, California.
Daniel's story is part of our Nuclear Family series about the human relationships that keep us safe in the atomic age. You can find other stories from the series at pri.org/nuclearfamily.